Hello, and welcome to Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson. I'm your host, Robert Washburn. This program is coming to you from the Williams Treaty Territory and Northumberland 89.7 FM. For the next 30 minutes, we will bring you important stories and issues facing Indigenous and non-Indigenous people living here in Northumberland County and across the country. It is your chance to become better informed, more engaged, and empowered as we all move together on the path to reconciliation. So join us for the next step on this journey. I'm delighted to welcome back Alderville Chief Tainar Simpson. Good to have you back, Chief.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here, Robert.
The Ontario government just announced it is doing its annual intake for the funding applications under its Indigenous Economic Development Fund and its Capital Community Grants Program. That is just over $9 million becoming available to entrepreneurs in the Indigenous community. Let's talk about economic development. Could you describe the various elements of the local economy in Alderville?
Well, I would say that we have a very strong economy in Alderville, and it hasn't always been that way. But we have a number of sectors that have been growing exponentially, not only for entrepreneurs, but also in the public sector. Just some examples are, so we have management, there's a lot of people in the health services, we have a lot of people in arts and culture. The recreation and tourism sector are getting larger. There's a lot of point of sales and stores on the reserve now. There's always been a number of trades, carpenters, equipment operators, plumbing, electrical, and agriculture has been one of the things that has been there from the very beginning since when it came to Alderville. And I guess also the construction and haulage. We have a lot of skilled and tradespeople that really have a good business acumen and are successful out there.
Why is it so important to have a diverse economy?
Well, I think you need a diverse economy to shelter you from bad times. So say the price of gas falls out and the gas stations aren't very good. We wouldn't want to be supported just by the gas stations or say anything else for that matter. So you want to be able to ride the highs and the lows safely.
There was one business in Alderville that we could kind of look at as exemplary. And one that I'm familiar with is the Butter Tart Empire Bakery. I understand they have a very unusual backstory. Could you share that story with us as an example?
Yes, the owner, he learned his trade during some time he had away. And so he was trying to bring something to the community and learn a new skill, basically. So he was able to pick up baking and he loved it. And then when he came back to the community, he was making cakes for weddings and people's birthdays. And everyone was like saying, this is amazing. You've got to do something here. So he got the idea to start a bakery. And I was on council at the time. So I remember him coming for a loan. And so we approved what we were able to approve. And then he, with his entrepreneurship spirit, he went out and he built the building. He hired the staff. He totally put up the kitchen, and it's quite a great kitchen inside there. It's a great space. So as you say, the rest is history, and people come for all over. They all mentioned the Butter Tart Empire, and we love those butter tarts.
Are there some other examples, some other stories that you might be able to share of other businesses that have been successful in this manner?
Let's see. There's always been a lot of skills development. So when people go away for whatever reason out of town, they often pick up a skill or two, and it helps them out there. But then if they come back to Alderville, they have this skill and they're quite often happy to share it. So like personally for myself, I was a researcher. So when I came back to Alderville, there was a research, archival research ability within Alderville that maybe wasn't there before. So I think it's the skills of the people and the knowledge of the people, and having them come back to the community and sharing it with the community, I think is happening more and more often now.
What is the band council's role in economic development? You mentioned just a moment ago about somebody coming before council and getting a loan. Can you describe what are the services and how they work?
Well, there's a number of programs and grants for businesses in Alderville. So we try to match these benefits with, good ideas. So the idea would be to put out, say, an application package for people who are interested in accessing funds. So then they will give us back their proposal. And if it looks like a good, solid business proposal, we would probably approve it or meet with them. But we have an economic development manager who's really good at this. So if someone comes to the community saying, I've got a business idea, she's able to point them in the right direction right away. Depending on what sector they're in, she'll have the links and the ideas of what she should do or they should do. So we have these skills inside of the community to be able to put people in the right direction. And it's been successful so far.
Now, what about provincial and federal funding? Are you able to access, or are these business people able to access? As I mentioned earlier, there's just an opening now for $9 million available to Indigenous people across the province. How do you tap into those, and do local businesses tap into those?
Yes, they do. So when we know that funds are available, we will try to push people down that road. So oftentimes it's contingent upon the entrepreneur, the applicant, to directly get those funds. But oftentimes, a letter from chief and council, an endorsement saying we believe this is a great idea, we want this business in our community, that often goes a long way to supporting that bid and also making it successful.
Often there is a stereotype of the types of businesses related to First Nations: gas, cigarettes, cannabis. If you drive through Alderville, you do see evidence of the dominance of these kinds of businesses. What is your response to this?
Well, I think it's not an ideal situation. We, again, as you were saying, we wanted to diversify the type of businesses we have. So there might be maybe too many of a certain kind of business, and that goes with a boom and bust economy. So whenever you have a big boom, a lot of people will enter into a business market, and then there might be some good times there for a few years, but then the business cycle will adjust and then it becomes very competitive. So we have a lot of competitive, gas stations and cannabis shops. So if you want to now get into that market, it's quite it's a mature market now. So it'll be a bit harder to make the money, and then you're taking away from everyone else. So I would say people have stopped getting into that market here, and it has reached its capacity. So if anything, we'd probably see a reduction in the number.
When you're talking, it sounds like a very open market system. However, does the band council ever limit licensing of businesses, or say, look, we've got too many gas stations, we're not going to give you a license? How does that work so that you do hit that sweet spot that you're talking about?
Well, we try to treat everyone fairly. So if someone's got a good plan and there's no reason to stop them, we generally let them go ahead. And with cannabis, that was a couple of chief and councils ago that permitted that to happen. So there's not really too much we can do, but then we have a cannabis law, a business law coming down, and that's more going to be about regulation, but we're not in the business of putting people out of business. So we would like to see that kind of sort itself out. We just know that there is a lot of competition, but they create jobs at the same time. So there's the strengths and the weaknesses you get with that. So, and you have the threats, the health threats, the safety threats. So we want to make sure that those type of issues are covered in our regulations.
What is the band council doing to develop larger, more complex types of businesses like manufacturing or non-service related businesses?
Well, we are actually in the middle of, actually more like the beginning of conducting a community comprehensive plan. And so this is something that our economic development manager is spearheading. So it's going to take a look at where we are, where we could be going, maybe some of the gaps that we can fill. So we know that, we'd love to get into agriculture as a community, community-led project. So this goes with sustainable food. So we're looking at all kinds of options. These container farms are becoming a big thing right now. where you can maybe have four or five containers and they produce a lot of food. And instead of having a farmer, you actually have more of a technician. So you can go to college and or even online and train to do these things. So it's we've known that this has a lot of success up north and in the more remote communities. So you could actually produce a lot more food in a container than you can on, say, a farmland. So then that opens up farmland to either use for traditional purposes or for Black Oak Savannah rejuvenation or for commercial endeavors or housing. So it really allows us to have more options across the board.
What's the timeline on this business development study?
Well, that's the thing. We're hoping maybe another year or so before it's finalized, because there's a lot that goes into a comprehensive plan. We have to engage with all the stakeholders, interview people, conduct like feasibility studies for anything that we might be interested in going for. And we're also looking at partnering with the other First Nations in the area too. So once the Williams Treaty First Nation settlement agreement came out and we had all seven First Nations working together, that really opened the door to say, hey, why don't we keep working together? So we've got a lot of development opportunities with the other First Nations.
Are there limits to what can be done in terms of business development?
I want to say that there's not. I mean, access to capital would be the big thing, but I don't think that there's anything that we couldn't get into if we didn't want to. So it's just a matter of putting your efforts into one direction. We can't do everything all at once. We are very limited in our human resources. So we got to be very strategic in what we are going to be doing, which is what this community comprehensive plan will guide us to do. So we want to make sure that our efforts reach the maximum benefit.
How do you encourage entrepreneurship, especially amongst young people in the community?
Well, I think basically saying like you can do what you love, you get to be your own boss. It's very interesting that 1/3 of our adult population works on the reserve, and the majority of those people working on reserve actually are self-employed and have their own businesses and create jobs for other citizens in the township and the county. So we have quite a high entrepreneurship spirit in Alderville, and it's really great to see.
Do you help them see themselves as entrepreneurs or as business people? Do you do business training? I know in other communities we have organizations that take on these tasks. Do you have similar things in Alderville?
We do. So again, our economic development manager, she is great for accessing the services. We have a small business loan program for up to $20,000 for a small business startup, seed money. So we really believe in our members. And if they've got a great idea and we see that great idea, we love to support them. So it's one of those things that it's just Alderville's always been business oriented and business minded. And a lot of it used to be in the tourism sector when the Americans would come up for the long weekends and everything. And then we would basically keep them here. We would outfit them. We would take them out on the canoes and show them how to fish and sell them all their gear. So we had that right from the beginning of, I guess, our time here in Alderville.
If you were to look in your crystal ball and look 5-10 years down the road, what do you envision? What do you see in terms of economic development in Alderville?
Well, I see some of the more big ticket items. We're looking at things like franchises, really attracting maybe large scale business, not necessarily industrial, but something that you know, will create a lot of jobs and produce a lot of revenue for the community. So I see us going big. So right now we have like the solar farm and we have things that they're big for us, but I think that we can go bigger. And the bigger you are, the more opportunities you create.
Thank you for talking to us about this. Please stay tuned to hear more conversations towards reconciliation with Tainar Simpson. This is Northumberland 89.7 FM, your local source for news and information. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I hope you're enjoying our chat today. I'm Robert Washburn, and I'm here with Tainar Simpson, the chief of Alderville First Nations. We are so glad you're joining us. In 2015, the Ontario government launched an Indigenous procurement program to support economic development of First Nations. Then, in 2021, the Canadian government announced a minimum target of 5% of the total value of its contracts being given to Indigenous business. However, a story done by CBC 2 weeks ago says the Assembly of First Nations has raised concerns about some of the companies getting these contracts. Tainar, could you describe the situation as you understand it?
Yes, I actually have a lot of experience in this area. So they've always had a number around there, 4 or 5% of all contracts by value would go to an Indigenous company. The rationale for that is that that's the percentage of First Nations population in Canada. So they're basically just trying to hit a target that accurately reflects Indigenous people in Canada. So when you get into that, and then you have the government trying to decide who is an Indigenous company, that's where things start to get a little bit tricky. As a First Nations person who started a company specializing in First Nations issues, I was often questioned if I'm an Indigenous company. And it's something that every couple of years I'd have to show them my status card, show them that what my business is. And it's like nothing's changed, and they know that nothing's changed. So I don't know why I'd have to keep doing that. But then you have other Indigenous companies where, you know, you can just say you're Métis, and once you say you're Métis, you don't really have a burden of proof on that. So then you're in that 5% as well too. So I think that there's two different tests for indigeneity, one for First Nations and one for Métis, and they're not the same. So that doesn't seem to be fair for First Nations.
This whole issue has seemed to arisen around the ArriveCan app. And on February 12th of 2024, the Auditor General of Canada released a report finding that those involved in the contracting, development, and the implementation of the app showed, and I'm going to quote here, a glaring disregard for the basic management of contract practices, and Canadians, quote, paid too much for ArriveCan. Now, the report estimates that the project cost around $60 million. But it was impossible to know the final cost due to bad management. Now, ArriveCan was one example of this issue because the company itself claimed that it had components that were Indigenous. And yet, when the research probed into this, it turned out it was on shaky ground. Can you describe what are some of the issues? You've described one with Métis and Indigenous, but what about these other practices where companies are going in and sort of glomming onto Indigenous businesses in order to get preferential treatment?
Yes. So that example would have been in the procurement strategy. There is an option for joint ventures, JVs, we call them. So you can have a non-Indigenous company partnering with an Indigenous company to secure these contracts. And this is where perhaps the regulations could use a little bit of tightening, because as far as I know, they didn't break any rules in the procurement strategy. So if this is allowed, then you really, it seems that they would be doing it. As long as it's allowed, people are going to do it. So then it becomes like, what was this Indigenous company specializing in? Yes, they actually were in that industry. Sometimes you have a JV, the non-Indigenous JV partner, teaming up with a company that isn't even in that field, and then maybe they're in something completely different, like making flower boxes, and they're getting these big security contracts or something. That should not be allowed, in my opinion. I think you really need to be in that industry to be getting those contracts, especially if you're the primary and you're the one that's putting out the proposal to try to get these contracts.
Are you aware of other examples of this happening? Could you name another company and maybe talk a bit about how that works or give us some specifics?
Well, maybe I won't name names, but back in the day, maybe 15 years ago when I was going for contracts, I still do. I remember I lost once to an Indigenous partnership. And the Indigenous company was a furniture company. And this was a document archival scanning high IT component project. So I thought that that was not fair that I lost to a furniture company, seeing as we were an archival company doing this type of work. And then they teamed up with one of the biggest non-Indigenous companies doing this in the country. So they got these Indigenous dollars when they weren't even leading the project or have any specialty in it.
So what are we really talking about here? I mean, the federal government says that this 5% target was surpassed in 2022 and 2023. And it is now at like 6.27% of contracts being awarded to Indigenous businesses, which amount to an incredible sum of $1.6 billion. So the money is flowing out. Well, you described earlier how you had to provide proof that you were an Indigenous. So what's lacking in terms of process that identifies Indigenous businesses? And who says, what is an Indigenous business?
Yes. So I think that the federal government shouldn't be defining who is Indigenous and who is an Indigenous business. This has been across the board, not just talking about business here. The government shouldn't be defining who we are as a people, who we are as a nation. For some reason, the federal government believes that it's entirely race-based when there's not a nation out there in the world that is based entirely on their race, and that's your mandatory component to be a member of that nation. We get to choose who our members are, who our citizens are, not the federal government. So every time you have the federal government trying to decide who we are, say who Indigenous businesses are, you run into problems because they create these tests, these rigid structures, and they have a level of bureaucracy that I don't think is necessarily needed. If you have the right checks and balances in place, you wouldn't need to be so heavy on the regulation side.
The Canadian Council for Indigenous Business has raised this issue of transparency and accountability. What is their role in all of this, and what are they trying to do to rectify it?
That's a good question. I believe they play a strong role. It's one of those organizations that you're not necessarily always sure what they're doing, but oftentimes when they come out, they have a great idea. They're very useful. In terms of, say, transparency, it'd be nice to know maybe fully what their mandate is. Anything that shines a light on these issues that advocates for Indigenous business, especially on reserve, we take as a good thing.
But why isn't there a registry of Indigenous business? Go online, everybody's there. It's run by some sort of oversight body, and here's the list.
Well, there is. There's something called the Indigenous Business Directory that you can access on the federal government website. So probably Indigenous Services Canada. So that, to me, they only use that for themselves, basically. It's not something that the general public could go out and access and say, I want to see an Indigenous company. It's for their own internal procurement strategy. So if they want to say, hey, is this business actually, do we certify them as Indigenous? Then they use it internally to give the check. For Alderville actually has a business directory. And if you want to be on that directory, you can contact our office, Olivia English. And we've had a business directory for at least 30 years now. And it's really good for people who want to know, say they want to get a plumber or an electrician, and they want to know if they're an Alderville member has that business. It's a good way to make connections that way.
So why aren't we suggesting this to some national, the Assembly of First Nations or something, that they have a directory like this? Is that not possible?
You'd think so. Something like just like a self-regulating list. So you could have like reviews, almost like a Better Business Bureau, have a business listed, who's the owner, what's their affiliation, what do they do, how many stars rating, other type of thing. So it'd be great if we actually had a business directory that was reliable and accessible to everybody in Canada.
One of the things about this, you mentioned earlier about venture capital and venture capitalists coming together in joint ventures. With all this controversy going around, how does this affect investment?
Well, I think that it has to be right. So if they're saying that 6% of all procurement spending has gone to Indigenous business, to me, that's not successful if only, say, 0.5% is actually going to Indigenous people. To me, I want to make sure we get that right. So if we have to, you know, tear some things down to rebuild it properly, I'm all for that. So it could hurt in the meantime, especially because I run my own business. I could see it creating lean times until they figure out the kinks. But to me, that cost is worth the long-term benefit. So I think that's important. We need to sit down and have an honest discussion about what we're trying to do here. And I know the government is trying to do this. I've been on a couple of Indigenous Services Canada meetings where they are talking about the permanent strategy, how to improve it. So I know that these discussions are going on. I don't know when they're going to come up with a new solution, or if they're going to, or how many more of these they're going to do. So it's something that's not transparent. We don't really know what their plan is and how long we have to wait for the better solution.
It's time once again to talk about what's going on in Alderville. Can you bring us up to speed?
Yes. So we have quite a busy month ahead. So I would like to say that we have a job fair October 24th, and that's going to be 1 to 3 at the ACC. So this is something that we have every year for, you know, mostly for our young people, or say you're trying to get into a new line of work, come out and see what's out there, the success stories that people have had. On October 28th, we have what we call Meal Prep Monday, and it's from 10 to 12 at the Hilltop. So this is where you can create pre-made meals for your entire week. We provide all the food. You come up, you put your meals together, you take them out, you put them in the fridge or the freezer, and then you have food for the week. Coming up on October 26th, we have our family Halloween dance, and this is an Alderville tradition going way back. We have games and prizes and pizza and activities for the whole family. But we ask that you bring a perishable item for the food bank. And let's see. So coming up in November 1st, the community priorities survey is due in Alderville. So this is a survey that guides the Alderville-Williams Treaty Settlement Trust. So the community tells us what they want the trust to focus on, and then they go in that direction. So if you wanted to get your voice heard, November 1st is the deadline for that. Coming up on November 9th, as I mentioned last podcast, we have our election code vote. And so this is something that we really encourage the members to come out and vote for. And ideally, they would vote in favor of ratifying the election code. This gets us out from under the Indian Act provisions for the election process. And then on November 10th, we have our Remembrance Day service. And this always happens the Sunday before regular Remembrance Day. So it just so happens to fall on the day before actual Remembrance Day this year. So we're going to be assembling at 12:30 at the community center for a walk to our cenotaph at 1 p.m. And so we have dignitaries from all over the county, often the MP, MPP. We have the pipe band, we have the color guard, and we go through a roll call of all of the vets that we've had fighting in the various wars from World War I up until modern wars. So this is just a way that we come out and say thank you to our veterans for their service, and to the ones that ultimately paid the price with their life. So this is a somber affair. We always have a good turnout, and for some reason, the weather's always wonderful. And then we go back to the community center for snacks and soup and discussion afterwards. And that it wraps up our events coming up in the next month.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for talking to me today, Taynor Simpson. It's been most interesting.
Oh, thank you. It's always a pleasure.
I want to thank Alderville First Nations Chief Taynor Simpson for talking to me today. I want to thank you for joining our conversation. And I hope you enjoyed this time to learn more about what's going on, the stories and issues facing Indigenous people living in Northumberland and elsewhere. That's all for this week. I'm Robert Washburn. Join us again next time for Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Taynor Simpson.